you're in this room, it's because you wanted to know a little bit more about biomimicry and biophilic cities. And we'll start off the conversation. I want to introduce Bill Browning. And we've got, I'm looking at your last name, Simon Nicholson, and Giles Hutchins is on the Skype call. So Giles will say hello. Giles?
Hello, everyone.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure you're there. We've officially started. And so the subject of this panel has to do with what can nature teach us about sustainability, specifically looking at biomimicry, what's new in biomimicry, what's new in biophilic design and innovation, and why do we need to know about it? Why is it important now in the 21st century? And so what I'll ask each of our panelists to do is just to quickly introduce themselves, tell us a little bit about your background, and then kind of tell us what you can add to the discussion, what's your area of expertise, and then we'll go on, and I'll be moderating some questions at the beginning. And then we'll pretty quickly jump into an open discussion here with you all. So as they talk, please write down your questions. And when you call out your questions, state your name, your affiliation, and then your question. And we'll be repeating the questions up here so that they can be recorded for our audio files for later. So I ask Simon, why don't you begin?
Sure. So my name's Simon Nicholson. I teach at American University in D.C. Forgive my voice. I have children who are petri dishes, and they make me sick. I'm kind of a strange person to start with because my work doesn't tend to be on things like biomimicry and biophilia. Instead, my work is on environmental politics writ large, and I've done a bit of work on politics of technology as it relates to environmental concerns. And so I tend to take a pretty critical view and sometimes a skeptical view of our ability to answer complex social challenges through technological innovation. And so that's the perspective and voice that I'll bring to the panel. So I've done work on geoengineering, on genetically modified foods, of questions of that nature.
Thank you. Bill.
I'm Bill Browning. I have a background in design, recovering real estate developer, and policy wonk. I'm a partner in a research and consulting firm based in Washington, D.C. and New York City. And two of our major areas of focus are biomimicry and biophilia. Our biomimicry work is focused in a couple areas. One is a five-year project for the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority to introduce biomimicry into industries in New York State, to both introduce the topic and the science, but then actually help them line them up for additional research funding to create new products and bring those products to market with support from the state of New York. Biomimicry, we're also doing work on what's called ecosystem biomimicry, of writing a series of building performance metrics based on quantifying the ecosystem services of that site pre-development. And so we have a big project for Google on that, and it's called Built Ecosystem Reference Standards. On the biophilia side, it's been an interest of mine for about 20 years now, and it's now we are producing design metrics about how we do certain measures within the built environment to help reconnect people with nature, with the intent is to help improve stress levels, cognitive function, and health outcomes.
Thank you. And Giles Hutchins is based in the UK. He's joining us via Skype. So Giles is being represented here by his book, which is available for sale here in the bookstore. Giles, you want to introduce yourself, please?
Okay, Lisa. Nice to be with you all via Skype. I co-founded BCI, Biomimicry for Creative Innovation. It's a global collaborative that looks at how organizations can be inspired by nature. Previously, I was global head of sustainability for a large multinational. And before that, I spent many years as a management consultant in business transformation with KPMG. And so my passion is applying nature's inspiration to sustainable business transformation. And my love is for nature herself.
Thank you. I guess my first question will go to Bill, and I just wanted to see if you can give me some examples of where, why are businesses and innovators, designers and city planners and hospitals interested in biophilia, and what does it mean for them to incorporate it into their projects?
In the hospital design world, there's a whole field of inquiry called evidence-based design, saying if I do this measure in a hospital, how does it affect the operations, and more importantly, how does it affect the healing outcomes for the patients? And one of the fields of inquiry within that has been on reconnecting people with nature in healing situations. And so that's why you now see healing gardens, these small gardens in the centers of hospitals all over the world, is that they find that there are much better health outcomes. People recover much faster when they have that ability to connect with nature. And we see, even in our daily lives, we see that play out in if I just spend 5 minutes in a park on a daily basis, my cortisol level, my blood pressure, and my heart rate will be lower. And it's not just a temporary effect of that 5 minutes in the park, but the cortisol level will be lower for hours and hours after that exposure.
Okay. And actually, I maybe should, because we come from all range of backgrounds here, so would you give us a couple of definitions between biophilia and biomimicry?
Sure.
How you define them?
Biomimicry is literally innovation inspired by nature, sort of asking the question, how does nature do that? And so maybe the most famous example, early example, would be the German scientist walking through the field with his wool pants, and comes home and finds the burrs stuck on his pants and is very upset as he's peeling them off his pants. And as he's peeling more and then more of them off his pants, he starts looking at them going, how does that work? And winds up creating Velcro, right? Biomimicry. So that's biomimicking form. The second would be biomimicking process. So that would be a friend of ours, a microbiologist, who was looking at methane digesters, right? Not necessarily sexy technology. One of them been around forever, and you put the stuff in, and it breaks down anaerobically over the course of the week, and at the end of the week, the system crashes, and you have to restock it. And he said, you know what, that's really weird, because most of us have methanogens. Methanogens are what in our gut and allows us to process food and in the intestines, and most of us don't tend to crash once a week and have to restart that whole system. So what's going on there? And it turns out that the methanogens in our intestines are bound into substrates, and as all these different populations, you have multiple populations there, die off, they slough off, and we excrete them. And so he had the insight that, how many of you have ever had a polypropylene sports shirt or thermal underwear? Right. What happens with that over time? It stinks, right? And you wash it, and you put it back on, and what happens?
It
stinks. That is methanogens binding into that substrate. AstroTurf is made from polypropylene. So our friend, Dr. McCulvey, said, I will line the cylinders of the digesters with AstroTurf, and I will seed it with methanogens, and they bind into that. And so he's created methane digesters that are artificial intestines. And rather than getting 30% energy capture out of them, he gets 70% energy capture out of asking that simple question of how does an, you know, how do methanogens, so mimicking process. The third level is mimicking ecosystems. And so the most famous examples of those are industrial ecologies. The one that gets written about the most is a power plant in Denmark, Kalundborg, where they took the waste heat to run greenhouses and a salmon farm, and the fish waste from the salmon farm gets used as a fertilizer, as this, and the sulfur coming out of the plant gets used by Novo Nordisk, a chemical and pharmaceuticals company. And so you wind up with all of these interlocking companies sharing their waste products as the resource for the interlocking companies. So that's an example of mimicking an ecosystem.
Thank you. So, Giles, I have a question for you. And that has to do with, you know, now we hear a little bit more about the different systems in biomimicry and why they're important. But so what is it, what's in the current state of affairs in the 21st century, our lives here, or in business, or in policy that makes biomimicry so important? You know, you've zeroed in on creative innovation, but can you give us an explainer on why this is important?
Well, certainly in the times that we live in at the moment, I think we all know that there's increased volatility and there's turbulence and unpredictability in the environments that we now operate in, socially, economically and environmentally. And the organisations that are agile, responsive, adaptive and resilient are clearly going to be able to adapt and deal with those volatile times ahead. And looking at nature, which is agile, responsive, adaptive, and resilient, is clearly a sensible, smart thing to do. And I think, as a Bill alluded to earlier, there's sort of kind of two levels here. There's one which is how do we gain immediate creativity just by looking at the problem differently. By asking nature, because we look at things from different angles. But there's also the other level, which is our innate biophilia, the fact that we are nature, and within us, in our authentic human nature, and also the natural world around us, when we tune into that, we gain another burst of creativity. And humans essentially are creative individuals, and tuning into that helps us become more innovative and therefore deal with the challenges that we have.
Right. So, Bill, can you give us some examples of where, you know, more examples of where this is being used, and, you know, where are some challenges, where are some challenges, and where it's being used, and where are some challenges in these applications?
So friends of ours are working on storm barrier protection for Charleston, South Carolina. Charleston, is as subject to getting whacked by storm surges and hurricanes as New York and other places on the East Coast. And what they kind of realized was it just didn't have the budget to armor the whole thing and build, you know, huge tall walls everywhere. And that's one way of protecting against storm surge. Another way would be to go back and look at how nature used to do that, and all around Manhattan, as the tip of Charleston, the peninsula of Charleston, all that, were reefs of oysters. And those reefs were really good at breaking up and dissipating the wave force coming in. And so there are obviously efforts in various places in New York and others to restore some of those reefs, but the realization is that the forces and, you know, how long it takes to do that is almost too long. Look at the structure of those and create barriers that are layered and break up force in the sort of structural way that the old reefs did. And oh, by the way, while we're creating that substrate, we can then populate it with living oysters and create habitat at the same time that we're building physical infrastructure. And their belief is, because there was an experiment that did this in London around the Millennium Dome, that it may actually be cheaper to build these seawalls this way than to build the traditional straight up and down metal and concrete structures.
Okay. That's interesting. So I guess I see that you have a Dasani bottle. Is that for a reason? We were talking about that earlier, that Dasani, this question is for Simon, how some of the innovations and around in this area and sort of greening what we consume and greening the things around us maybe aren't so green. Can you just give us some examples of, you know, where what questions we might need to ask? We were talking about, is it real, or what? How can it be measured? And what are some ways that, as journalists, we can approach it and not just take everything lock, stock, and barrel as being the greatest new thing, but apply some critical thinking as well to some of these subjects?
Sure. And I have to preface my remarks by saying that I'm really thrilled to be on a panel with Bill and with Giles, because these guys are the real deal when it comes to biomimicry and biophilia. I know some of Bill's work through mutual friends in D.C., and Giles's book, I think, is fabulous. And so some of these remarks do not necessarily apply to the two gentlemen I'm sharing the podium with. One thing I think it's really important to keep in mind is that the talk about biomimicry and biophilia fits into a broader conversation in which anything natural is good. And so there are lots of corporations and lots of other folks out there now who are saying, look at this new technological innovation, it somehow mimics nature, and so therefore we're doing something that's really positive. In fact, that's not necessarily always the case. And so you're quite right, Lisa, I'm pretty transparent in bringing the Dasani bottle. This is a prop. Some of you will have seen this bottle. It's their new bioplant bottle made of 30% bioplastics. This is not necessarily biomimicry, but they're saying that because we've taken a plant and turned it into a plastic, therefore this is somehow green. If it were fully a bioplastic, it could be composted potentially. That might have some environmental benefits. This goes into the traditional recycling streams. It's not clear that there are any energy or materials benefits in doing this, but what Coca-Cola does get to do with this Dasani bottle is to put a big green leaf on their bottle. And this, to me, this looks like a very pretty transparent example of greenwashing. The bigger problem, of course, here, if you look at this bottle, is that it contains water, and that's just stupid. That's an ecological crime to take water and to put it into plastic bottles and to be selling it in places where you can get perfectly good water out of the tap. That's the bigger problem that this doesn't even start to address. So the reason that I think Giles' work and Bill's work is so important is because they're not talking just about technological tricks to hide things, they're talking about societal transformation, which is a completely different level of thinking. And so I always ask three different questions of technological innovation that I think are crucial to see whether they actually do make sense and are gesturing towards the right things. So the three questions are quite straightforward. Number one, is it real? Number two, to what end is it directed? And question three, who benefits? So if you think about those questions in turn, is it real? This is not a real innovation. This is just, there's nothing to be gained by doing this. If you think about to what end is it directed, this bottle here is directed towards clouding the conversation around bottled water and making us feel virtuous about making a purchase that should not be available to us. The bigger problem is that we need to be redirecting the sorts of choices that are available rather than hiding behind technological trickery to make us feel that somehow these decisions make sense. And question three, who benefits out of this bottle? Coca-Cola? Probably nobody else. And there are many examples that I can kind of go through and perhaps we'll have time for that start to unpack this conversation.
Right. So you know, that's something that we as journalists can do is, you know, when we approach some of these stories that come across our desk every day, it's, you know, who benefits, to what end, and I guess, is it real? I mean, is this a real innovation? Giles, I'd like to see if you could talk to a little bit now as either responding to what Simon had to say about what are some of these innovations and do they really matter. But I'd also like to ask you if you can talk a little bit more about in your module two, you know, of your book, Nature as Teacher, and, you know, sort of how our organizations are using this or how we can learn a little bit more about that in living our daily lives in through, you know, sort of innovative or creative thinking.
Okay, yeah. Well, I can kind of take the social transformative component of what Simon mentioned and sort of blend that into the nature of teacher, nature as mentor part that you talk about, Lisa. And building on what Bill said about form, processes, and ecosystems, which is kind of the way that, the levels are talked about in biomimicry. I mean, what I talk about in the nature of business is a kind of a pyramid where you have at the bottom of the pyramid places, then you move up to products, product design, then you move to processes, and then further up the pyramid you go to people, and at the top, purpose. And now those at the bottom is where we have most of the biomimetic work going on at the moment. So that's your form work, your sort of architecture, shaping design of products, you know, the wingtips on planes that you see emulating eagles' wings, etc. We're moving into a very interesting space with processes. Traditionally, like your industrial ecology, your closed loop, where waste of one becomes food of another, like we see in ecosystems. Interestingly, moving into information flows, which has a societal and it has a business transformational aspect, because it looks at how we interact as teams, as diverse stakeholders within our organization, but of course across our organizational boundaries. We tend to either assume that we're separated, that our organizations are separated, and in nature everything is semi-permeable. And it's recognizing that semi-permeability and looking at how we can build relationships like nature does in ecosystems. That gets us thinking differently in terms of having systemic change within business ecosystems and society. And then moving up to the top of that pyramid, purpose. What's our purpose? As Homo sapiens, as wise humans, is it purely short-term profit maximization, i.e. greed, or is it something else? What is the purpose of the city? Is it there to drive out profit for certain individuals, or is it there to improve the well-being of those people, enhance the sense of purpose of the individuals and the collective? And that's where nature can be immensely interesting in the way you look at that, not just in terms of the natural world around us, which is vitally important for that, but also our own nature, what makes us authentic, and how we look at what our true essence is and how that merges with the natural world around us. And the good news is that philosophers for eons, any intelligent, wise person has been often looking at nature for the answers, whether it be Einstein, Confucius, Leonardo da Vinci. You know, all the lessons are there for us to pick up on.
I guess my last question for the panel, and we're going to be opening it up to you all, so start thinking about your question now. My last question to everyone, and I'll start with you, Giles, again. So what is the potential for biomimicry to influence our thinking widely? Whether it's, you know, no matter what our areas, whether we're living in cities, and maybe we can talk about that most particularly. So what is the potential for biomimicry either in, you know, in our cities or where we're living today?
I think it's immense. I think that we've got to be careful with biomimicry in terms of it sort of wraps itself a little bit in a scientific limiting perspective, but that's no bad thing because it gets us going. After all, a lot of what we do is quite scientifically orientated, and that's perhaps a good place to start. Yet it doesn't need to be limited in that sense. It can be nature inspired as well, and that drifts into the biophilic aspect. But I think there's a lot there. There's a lot that we can use for our frameworks and tools, not just in design and engineering of our cities and the way in our societies are structured, but the way in which we engage as people. And I think that, that helps not just lower crime, pollution, improve better health, social connections, but it can also enhance our sense of purpose as individuals and as collective groups. And I think there's a very powerful learning there which helps us with these transformational times that we find ourselves in.
Bill, would you want to follow up on that? The, really, what is the potential? What are you seeing? The potential for biophilia to be a part of our innovations with our cities, innovations with business, sort of innovations in our thinking here in the 21st century?
Let me separate the two. Right. On biomimicry, it's just sort of one more place to look for ideas and inspiration, okay. Right? I mean, there are cultural places there and that, but it's an additional sort of solution set. And to Amory Levin's jokes, nature's been doing this for 3.8 billion years, and things that didn't work got recalled by the maker. They are extinct. But there are lots of other things out there to draw inspiration from. For us, one of the pieces has been working with building owners and having this conversation about, are we trying to save 30% of the energy against what standard? That's just so uninspiring, right? As opposed to saying, wow, okay, so in 1609, this city block, when it was forest and a stream, sequestered 3.7 tons of carbon a year. This same city block that we're working on right now today has a 3 million square foot building on it with 1 million square feet of data centers and puts out 87,000 tons of carbon a year. And so the building owners have asked us to think about a path with them over the next 30 years about how we go from 87,000 tons to minus 3.7 tons a year. I have no idea how we get there. But it opens up conversations about creativity and thinking about stuff in ways that, let's save 30% of the energy, never does, right? And that's just, that's just the energy part. We're also doing the same with water and other materials flows on that site and that building as well. So in that case, trying to mimic the ecosystem services of the site, asking the simple question, could I run a building as beautifully as the ecosystem did here, changes your mindset in a very fun, very interesting way and engages all kinds of people that normally wouldn't get involved in the conversation.
So are there specialists in this? I mean, your company is a specialist in this. What is the growth in your competition?
Fortunately, we're partnered with the Biomimicry 3.8, which is mm-hmm. Janine Benyus's group who wrote the original book, Biomimicry. And there is a growing network of folks doing biomimetic work. Giles is really leading a lot of the charge in the UK, but there are increasing numbers of researchers getting involved in this all over the place. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't call them so much competition as much as cohort.
Right. So it's kind of like the thing where, when dark rinse blue jeans are popular, then everybody buys more dark rinse blue jeans. So every blue jean maker wins. Is that basically the same?
Yeah.
The same thing. So the more people are doing this, the more people getting into this field, the more we all will benefit from it.
And then on the biophilia side, the connection to nature is, particularly in the built environment, now that we've got half the world's population living in cities, and stress and all other, all sorts mm-hmm. of stress-related health issues, the more we can connect people to nature and the built environment, the better.
Mm-hmm.
That's a place where there's so much to be done.
Simon, I think we discussed earlier some of the impacts of the unintended consequences of some of the green spaces that may be driving out some of the minority populations in some of the more economically challenged regions. Can you discuss that and sort of what that means and how? I don't know if you looked at how that can be approached in a new way or...
And let me touch, too, on the original question that you asked, which is what is the potential for this way of thinking? Right. I think the potential is immense, and the potential is also immensely troubling. As more and more people get into the field, then there are more and more reasons to be skeptical about what some people are selling. Right. And so I think all the more reason to be asking these sorts of critical questions. This is not to say there isn't immense potential, but always to be skeptical and critical when we hear about these new innovations. So, for instance, the conversation that we were having earlier was about city design, and there's a very famous example of the work of Robert Moses in New York City. And Robert Moses, as many of you will know, was known as New York's great builder, was a person who led the creation of much green space and lots of built environment in New York after the Great Depression and through the 60s and 70s. A famous story that's told about Robert Moses is that as he created green space for the city, he also created overpasses. And the overpasses could be passed through by people with vehicles, but not by people who were riding in buses. Yeah. So who gets to access the green space then? Well, it's affluent people who can afford cars, so typically rich white people. And who gets excluded from the green space? Well, it's poor black people in particular. There's question about whether this was an intended consequence or an unintended consequence of his design. But I think that the question always to be asked of these sorts of innovations, again, is to what end is this directed? If we look across our greenest cities now, we often find that the greenest innovations, so-called, green condos, for instance, that go up with energy-efficient design and green roofs and systems that hold water and so forth, they tend to be very, very expensive. And often these green innovations are part of a process of gentrification that excludes certain people from access to these new societal innovations. And so as we're creating new green space, we're also creating further social inequity. And so there's a politics in this technological design that we always need to pay attention to. Every time we have a new form of design, a new technological innovation, there's politics on the front end, political contestation around what's this going to look like, and then there are political effects of the innovation. Sometimes new technologies and new design principles can calcify existing societal relations in potentially troubling ways. And so I think the key question to ask is the question that Giles just raised. What's our purpose? What's our purpose in doing these things? If we're designing in a greener way in our cities just for profit, so we can charge a premium for condo space, then sure, we're drawing on notions of biomimicry, but we're not aiming towards the sort of societal transformation that will ultimately take us towards sustainability. That's probably enough on that.
So I'm going to poke at Simon a little bit here.
Yes,
I'm going to pull out Tocqueville and the comment he had that is very, very, very true about residential construction. And that is, if the rich have it, then eventually everyone will have it. And if you look at the sort of history of residential construction, particularly in the U.S., is that the innovations typically are paid for first by those wealthy folks. And so, if you look at the Visionaire and the Solaire and these very high-end condo and apartment buildings in lower Manhattan that have the green roofs and all the green features in them, the lessons learned from that and all of that then allowed things like the project that Jonathan Rose just was able to complete in the Bronx, which is an affordable housing project that is entirely covered with gardens. It's this huge sort of stair-step building, and you can literally go start at a low level and go up layer by layer by layer by layer through this whole complex, and it's all entirely gardens. Now, the ability to do that only came about after the builders and, more importantly, the code officials and everyone else in New York had enough experience and enough trust in green construction and green roof, more importantly, green roof construction in New York City, that they gained from some of those earlier projects. So, you know, it can't just be the wealthy. Everybody's got to get it, but I'm not going to poke too much at doing it first with the high-end stuff, because I'd rather experiment on the wealthy than experiment on the poor.
And with that, let's open it up to questions. Does anyone have one? A few? Francesca? Can you tell us who you're?
Okay, I'm Francesca Lyman, and I'm a freelance journalist. I've written a good bit about sustainable cities and green building and issues like that. And the conversation about if the rich have it and everything else will have it kind of leads to the idea of if everyone has it, sometimes it can be negative, that it's a positional good. If everyone has cars, then, you know, you may lose traffic, you may lose congestion, those things. And it reminds me of a conversation I had with Frank Kent in Projects for Public Spaces, where he said that environmentalists always want to have green as part of it. Parks, pockets, pocket best parks, you know, without looking at some of the other issues that, you know, sort of a single-minded green view could blind you to other things. And so he believed that the environmental movement became a movement of suburbanites who all moved out of cities and then left behind the virtues of urban spaces. And I just was wondering whether there's any wisdom to the idea that the focusing too much on just greenery to the exclusion of design that takes in other aspects, community participation, architecture, various things like that may leave out other equally important points, qualities in the building.
Is this for everybody to answer? Okay. I have to repeat the question and correct me if I'm wrong, so Giles can hear it as well. The question is, I'm not sure how much of that you heard, but environmentalists tend to want to have green without looking at all of the issues comprehensively. And is this a single-minded green new vision? Has this blinded people to other things that we're missing? And like too many cars on the road, even if everybody wants cars, everybody wants the same thing. So, Giles, do you have a sense of yes?
Also, I mean, you know, like really big issues like climate change.
Yeah, big issues like climate change.
We might get too focused on this to the exclusion of it.
Right. Okay. Go ahead, Giles.
Yeah. Okay. I kind of got bits of that. Having been in sustainable business for a number of years, what often to me is that we often, for very noble and motives, we often deal with effects and leave the root causes, the root sources gaping. And, you know, I think a lot of these challenges, whether it be cars on the road, whether it be, I think I heard creative participation, ill health, climate change. Fundamentally, if you look at some of the root sources, they come from same places. And interestingly, our relationship with nature is primary. Now, there are many ways to help develop what used to be an innate relationship with nature in our history, and it's not just about greening spaces. I appreciate that, and there are multiple ways to get that across, creative participation being one, for instance, but there is a primary cause here which is very important, which helps with so many other effects. That's I think all I can say. I'm sure Simon and Bill will, you know, add a lot, I'm sure.
Do you want to respond as well?
Yes, so we're all familiar now with an expanded understanding of sustainability that isn't just about the green side, but also economic and the social portions of sustainability. I'm sure that Bill and Giles, when they're doing their work and in their designs, are not just paying attention to environmental implications of their decisions, but are also looking at community, looking at social effects and so forth. And I think, absolutely, as designers, as thinkers, we all need to be paying attention to that. There is kind of this strange moment that we find ourselves in. We think about the environmental situation now. There's a quote that I've heard David Orr and Paul Hawken both use, which is something like, if you consider the environmental situation and you're optimistic, you don't know enough. And then David Orr goes on, but if you're pessimistic, then you're ineffective. So we need to find that sweet spot in the middle, which he calls hope. If we think about what these guys are offering, they're selling us hope. But hope can also be intoxicating and can be blinding. So I take your point. If we find hope in these environmental innovations but exclude the other things, then we're hopeful about ultimately the wrong thing. Sustainability is an orientation. It's not an end point. We're never going to wake up one morning and say, we're sustainable now. Now we can start dealing with other challenges. But the orientation has to embrace more than the green. It also has to embrace society and economics and so forth as well.
Yeah, I could add all the parks possible, all the community gardens possible. If the social structure isn't there to sustain them, then I really haven't done anything. So some of it is, is societal repair. They go hand in hand. It's one of the reasons why I'm so inspired by the schoolyard greening projects in New York City and the rapid growth of urban agriculture movement in New York City and where it's coming from. I got a friend, Karen Washington, who runs a network of community garden groups in New York, learning from her sort of the shifts that happen socially in those neighborhoods as those neighborhoods form those. Things around violence, things around intergenerational conversations that weren't happening before. In some ways it's these are enablers. The biophilic design components are enablers for these broader social conversations.
Thank you. Yes?
Yeah, I'm Susan Loren, a freelance journalist in Colorado. So I'm not a conspiracy theorist by any means, but the more I hear you talking about Coca-Cola's, Dasani's 30% biopolymer bottle, I wonder, a company like that has so much money to put the research in beyond what's already known about what's compostable and what's not. It has to be 100% biopolymer to be that way. Do you think there's some deliberate attempt at public obfuscation? Because already what's compostable and what's not, there's such social confusion. I live in Boulder. Everything's supposed to be biodegradable, but so many companies, so many restaurants have, the Nature Work biodegradable dinnerware, but they don't have bins. I mean, that may be a sort of unintentional craziness, but a company like Coca-Cola, I mean, how could it be unintended? I guess my question is, do you think there's some ulterior motive in having it only 30%?
Can you repeat the question?
We'll do no good. We'll just add nothing to the landfill.
Can you repeat her question, please, before you answer it?
So to try and summarize the question, it was something like, you say you're not a conspiracy theorist, but sometimes the designs that were presented would look like they might be part of some conspiracy. So, for instance, is this bottle meant to be composted or is it meant to be recycled? Who makes these decisions and to what end?
I mean, if there's a conspiracy, just any way to create public confusion.
Right.
Beyond to get their label of green.
So our company's striving to create public confusion. I try not to be a conspiracist either, but I don't believe there are a handful of old white guys in a smoky room making decisions for the rest of us. But sometimes the world sure looks that way. I mean, if there were to be a conspiracy around obfuscation of the options available to us with bottled water, the result would be something like this. I mean, consider the history of recycling in the United States. Companies some time ago a number of companies lobbied quite hard for recycling rather than reuse. The old system used to be you'd take a glass bottle, you'd wash it, you'd take it back to the store, you'd get some money back for it, or there'd be some other process by which bottles would be reused. Companies said, no, that's not the future of the green approach that we're going to take to you know, to materials flows. It's going to be about recycling. And so we've locked in the system where most bottles in the country aren't recycled, and those that are just add to a flow of materials that is just nuts. It doesn't make any ecological sense. And so that was, on the part of companies, absolutely intentional. Absolutely intentional. Because the purpose was to make more profit. And as long as you know, one thing about rapacious capitalism is that it can take any problem that we can identify and can find a way to make money off it. Yeah? And some of the stuff that really troubles me about so-called some of the green designs that we see are that they seem to me to fit into that mold. They're about hiding the real problems that we face rather than tackling them head on. They're about, as Giles put it, they're about taking on effects rather than taking on root causes. If the root cause is that we have a corporate system that is set up to make profit, that puts that value ahead of broader human value, more green products aren't going to solve that. We're not going to get our way out of the hole that we're in by greener consumption. That's a myth. It doesn't make any sense. I'm not a conspiracist, but...
Giles, would you like to chime in here and provide us with an answer to that question as well?
Okay. Interestingly, I was at a work. It was for future leadership, and was working with some different leaders in different sectors. And there was someone very senior from the banking sector here in the UK. And what he got, in inverted commas, was the cause for ethics in the banking sector. And the reason he felt he got that was because that's what his customers are after. And it's important for their brand now that customers need to see those ethics. So for me, what I heard there and what I felt was that individual is doing ethics because it's something that the customer wants. And he's not really getting what the ethics means in terms of getting deeper into what are the values? Well, what does this mean for me? What's my purpose as a business? And yes, often we have knee-jerk reactions, especially, as Bill said, when the whole system paradigm is set up purely for short-term profit maximization. It's very easy for us to do things for that reason, for that ulterior purpose, rather than actually thinking deeply about, well, what are we about? All I can say to balance that is that with the new younger generations coming through, and with the transparency we now have with social media and internet and so forth, it is more and more difficult not to be authentic. And so therefore, the wisdom is in those that are actually learning to be authentic in what they do in their businesses and their operations.
Can you give us an example of that, something very authentic and...
Well, I mean, Paul Polman, who's the global head of Unilever, I mean, it's an interesting company. It's the largest fast-moving consumer goods company in the world, and clearly does a lot of activities which are far from sustainable. Yet, having met with him and worked with, engaged and seen what they're doing, I do feel there is an authenticity there. There is a belief in something transformative. Yet for him, it's still, or for any senior organization that's listed on the stock market, it's a balance. You can't just suddenly...
We're losing your audio every once in a while here, Giles.
Go purely for the long... I do apologize. I don't want to repeat myself, but hopefully, yes, I do think there are more examples of authentic leaders at all levels, not just in social innovation organizations, but in large corporations.
Bill, would you have a response to that?
Corporations.
Go ahead.
You know, some of it is, are you asking fundamental questions about and setting goals and all of that, or are you shooting for the 30%? Mm-hmm. And for most, it's, you know, 30%. And in some cases, the 30% is obviously better than where we are today. And so, you know, applaud them and all of that. But sometimes they make, you know, you see kind of odd, why did you do it that way decisions about stuff as well. And you also, in some of the bigger companies, you have so many different players that the clarity is not there. So I know in a lot of our projects, we'll typically, in our building products projects, people will go, oh, you know, we want to do LEED Gold, we want to do LEED Platinum. And I'm one of the founders of the Green Building Council, and I'm a big supporter of LEED. But if someone comes to me and says that, our response is typically we don't want to work with them because what we want to know is what are they actually trying to achieve? What's important to them? So when we do a design workshop on a new project with folks, we start with trying to find out what are their goals with the building socially. You know, what are the key issues that they want to address? Is it issues around water? Is it issues around energy? Is it issues around people's health and well-being? What matters to them? And articulate that and get that articulated, and then get into what the building design actually is. And then maybe at the end of the process, then you pick up something like the LEED rating system and you use it for what it was originally created as a yardstick. It's a measuring tool. It's not a design tool. It's a way to measure. But for some folks, there's, you know, the mindset is, oh, we'll just do this. And I'm not going to entirely bash that because there is some value into having incremental improvement. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in some cases, you know, the point of, you know, what was it, Lord Carnarvon's method, the old English quote about if something's not worth doing, it's not worth doing well.
Yes. Lizzie. I'm sorry. No, then EJ after her. Okay. Yes.
Hi. My name's Emily York.
Oh, Emily. I'm sorry. Wrong.
I'm a freelancer based in New York, and I'm actually asking this question in part in the context of an article I'm working on for a blog called 100 Resilient Cities. I wondered what Simon's response was to Bill's point about I'd rather experiment on the rich than on the poor when it comes to things like the, you know, we started with Solaire and then got to Rose's affordable housing project in the Bronx. I mean, do you feel that advances that we achieve in that fashion are, like, legitimate, so to speak? Like, does trickle-down work in this instance? Or is there another way you think that things should be, you know, that biophilia and biomimicry should be implemented in the city?
Okay.
I think the poem was brilliant, and very well taken. I too would rather experiment on the rich than the poor. At the same time, I think when we look at the way cities progress through time, the promise that stuff that happens for the rich will ultimately benefit the poor, I don't think always plays out. And so again, we get back to these questions of purpose. If we want to design green cities for the benefit of everybody. It seems to make sense to have everybody from the outset included in the conversation about what the city is going to be ultimately transformed into. And too often these decisions are made by a handful of people, largely to their benefit, with the hope that down the road things will happen for others. And so as we're talking about design principles, I think another principle we have to keep in mind is a straightforward one that should resonate with an American audience, democracy. Let's make sure that we get a range of appropriate voices into conversations around what a city is for and to whose benefit will be used.
EJ?
Yeah, and I'll make the argument that, you know, for instance, in New York City, if you look at the rooftop agriculture movement, it came from the community gardeners looking for more space, right? And it came from folks working in not in Manhattan but other boroughs. but it, you know, it's catching on across the city in a way that I never expected to happen as quickly as I'm seeing it. You know, it's astonishing. Our office is in Chelsea, and we put in our green roof 7 years ago, and you know, it was yeah, NRDC's across the street from us. And they go, oh my God, look at that, right? And you know, now we go up on our green roof and look, oh, there, right? I mean, they're kind of happening all over the place. But so, you know, in some cases, the innovation does come bottom up as opposed to top down. But just, you know, in terms of, you know, thinking about diffusion, typical diffusion of technological progress in the building trades usually starts with the more expensive buildings, and then, you know, heads into other places. Partially because the more expensive buildings have got margins in them where you can pay for the learning curve and you can pay for the experimentation. Having done a bunch of stuff in affordable housing, the margins are so damn thin, it's very, very hard to do experimental stuff there. But in the high-end stuff, I can learn, you know, learn lessons there and then transfer it over.
Go ahead.
I'm E.J. Hirst from New Society Publishers. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about the recent science and investigation that's been done on the incredible physiological effects of putting your body in contact with nature. You mentioned earlier about cortisone going down and the fasting. I wondered if you could tell us more about that.
Can we repeat the question, please?
Sure. The question is, what's some of the recent science on biophilia and the connection with nature? Really, a lot of the research, I mean, a lot of it's been intuitive for a very long time, right? You read Olmsted and read his descriptions of why they were doing the parks in the cities, right? They described them as lungs. They described them as ways of, well, they didn't use the word stress, but basically relieving social and personal stress, right? So intuitively, we've been known this for a very long time. Where it starts getting into sort of a slightly more scientific basis is in the UK in the 1970s with a geographer named Jay Appleton, who asks what seems like a somewhat simple question, but why are some landscapes preferred over others? And then starts picking it apart and analyzing it. That gets picked up by folks like Stephen and Rachel Kaplan at the University of Michigan, who take it much further and get to the point of saying, you know, one of the reasons why being out in nature is restorative is maybe because you just don't have to focus on things as much as you do when you're in the built environment. You can navigate the world in what they called soft fascination and give your higher cognitive functions a rest. So in the last year, the neuroscience has finally caught up with them and says, yes, in fact, that's what's going on. When I'm taking that walk through the park, the brain is processing in a different area and at a different level of function than when I'm having to deal with the built environment. And so, you know, why do you get inspiration sometimes when you're out in nature? Well, there's a lot of sensory input there, but it's sensory input that you can, for the most part, process without having to engage those higher cognitive functions, and so you're actually giving that part of your brain a rest, a break. Mm-hmm. And so it may be processing something in the background and go, there, boom. And in the last year or so, the neuroscience has finally caught up with that. More and more understanding among folks, particularly the folks doing the fMRI experience of looking where things are going on in the brain, of increasing understanding that experiences of nature are processed in a different part of the brain than experiences of the built environment. And have different outcomes, and so, and the same sound associated. I mentioned at lunch some experiment on the insight that traffic a lot of times sounds like if you just listen to the sound of traffic, it sounds like waves. And so a synthesized version of that was shown to people, and they looked at waves, and that sound got processed over in the part of the brain that's dealing with nature and viewed as positively. That exact same sound played with a videotape of watching traffic, that sound gets associated with the traffic and is given a negative connotation. So, you know, why is still the remaining question. Similarly, we sort between if we look at a wood table and a metal table, right? Might be the same design, but one is viewed differently than the other. Same table. And the brain goes, oh, wood, okay. Wood was tree, was alive, is still somehow connected to nature. Metal, even though it comes out of the ground and technically is natural, but the brain goes, nah, that wasn't alive. And so it gets processed in a different place. Now, that doesn't answer the why. We still don't know the why. We're getting to the level where understanding, yes, this is happening. The why is still the question. But there's increasing work on that in the neuroscience community, and there's a whole science and design now group, Neuroscience for Architecture, that's doing supporting some really good work. The Environmental Design Research Association, EDRA, is supporting some really good work as well. And the various universities have very, very cool research going on. The other place is where some of this work was going on was at the National Institutes of Health, a team led by Esther Sternberg, and that team has now moved to the University of Arizona, a group studying integrative health. And what she realized was that the built environment has a significant relationship to the health outcomes. She's got a book that came out a year or two ago, I think. I read it. It's fantastic. Healing Spaces, that talks about this from a doctor's standpoint, from a research doctor's standpoint.
Yes.
I'm just curious. I was thinking about this issue of authenticity and also this issue of causal effects, fundamental effects. It seemed like the elephant in the room that we're still not talking about is carrying capacity. What can our planet handle? And the standard really ought to be what can life on this planet survive in terms of what the planet is not being eroded away so fast that life can't survive. So I'm curious, what do you guys think we need to know, either from biophilia or biomimicry or other fields, that will fill in this gap? Because when it's carbon and water, we may be getting to a really big jump off point.
So I guess if I can repeat the question, I'm not sure. What's your name?
Dodd.
Okay. Dodd had the question of, you know,
what do you need to know in terms of designers and in terms of those who critique designers to understand what our carrying capacity is?
Right. So what does the design community need to know about our carrying capacity on the planet? So, and
I thought about asking them that,
right,
and realized they probably need to ask scientists that.
Right. So maybe Giles has something to say on this as well. Giles, are you there?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I think that I can point you to the Natural Step in Canada, who are doing some good work on this. And there's a lot of science already out there pointing to our influence on carrying capacity and our overshoot capacity as it currently is. I think I'd just like to balance this because clearly I think so Bill and Simon can add a lot to the scientific side after me. I'd like to just balance that with also some of the quality as well as the quantity, in the fact that it's important for us to recognize that it's how we do things as well as how much of things that we do. And that's becoming increasingly, I think, useful, is that we are part of nature, and that the more we recognize how we act and interact with each other and nature, the more we inherently become sustainable. And sort of manufacturing another sustainability that we bolt on to how we currently.
This is why we should not trust technology.
Yes. So Giles, you're coming in and out. So I'm you're coming in and out almost completely. So I'm going to actually put the question over to somebody else, see if we can figure this out a little bit.
You know, someone from a design background, I don't know how to control the population and all that, but you know, sort of do know that more and more evidence that urban dwellers per capita have less impact than otherwise. And so how do I make, for me, biophilia and biomimicry, or how do I make that impact less? But more importantly, how do I make their lives better? Is the way I look at it. One of the essays that has had more impact on me than almost anything I've ever read was an essay by David Quammen, an outside, it must have been somewhere in the early 90s. And I don't remember the name of the original essay, but you hear people refer to it as the Planet of Weeds scenario. And what David was saying in that was, he says, you know, I think what will likely happen is somewhere between the Pollyannas and the Cassandras. Right? He says, I believe that eventually we are going to wind up with clean air, and we probably are going to wind up with clean water. But along the way, we will have lost so many other species and so many other experiences and all that, that all that's going to be left with us are the weeds, the pigeons, the macaque monkeys, the coyotes, the opportunistic species that can deal with humans. But we'll lose the tigers and the fierce animals and the rare fragile things. And how sad and tragic and lonely is that?
Possibly a few billion human beings if climate projections pan out.
Yeah. And so, you know, that essay, if you get a chance, I wish I could remember the original name of it, but you'll hear that essay referred to as a Planet of Weeds scenario. And it was one of the more impactful things I've ever read.
It's very consistent with some of the projections. Place-based failure.
Right. It's one of the reasons why we're pushing on this idea of ecosystem services as the metric of asking this question. You know, can I be as good as the ecosystem? And it's actually led to, for us, some interesting outcomes. One of the ones that we're looking at water use and it being complex in New York City, and you know, when you have a big commercial building, you have cooling towers up on top of the building, and they're putting evaporating water up into the air. And you know, the normal response is, "Oh, that's really stupid," right? So if you back up and look at what the forest was doing, and look at that, and suddenly realize, "Oh, you know what? The forest here was evaporating a lot of water into the air." And it actually helped moderate the climate in that place. Okay, so now how do we get to a water balance where what we're evaporating into the air is obviously, you know, I'm not going to be able to entirely restore the forest on that, although we're doing some projects now using an idea of green area ratio where we're putting as much horizontal leaf canopy on the building as the footprint of the building. And that comes from friends of ours in Singapore who inspired us on that. But even so, still, I'm not going to restore that entire forest in there. I've got 7 floors of people and building there.
So we have, I guess we need to wrap it up here. And so what I'll do is Giles is back on the line. Hi, Giles. Thank you for calling back. I'd like to give everybody, the panelists, at least one opportunity for just a minute of closing remarks, just to, you know, what's the main takeaway here that you want us to know? So, Giles, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
True sustainability is being in harmony with nature. So this is just as much about science as it is about our sensuous and spiritual attunement with nature.
Thank you. Phil?
I don't know how to build on that. That's awesome.
That's pretty awesome.
I guess the only thing I will do is watch the Terrapin website, our website. We've got two white papers that will be coming out next year. One is on the ecosystem metrics based on the building world and ecosystem services. And the second one, actually the one that will come out first, is going to be a series of design metrics based on biophilic design. And you'll be able to download those off our website. And anyone who gives me their card, I'll make sure that you get the email blast as soon as as those come out.
Excellent. And Simon?
I'm going to come back to this question about carrying capacity. By way of final remarks, there was a UN report released in 2005, the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which many of you will have seen. The punchline from that report was, humanity is so degrading ecological systems that there is no guarantee that future generations of human life can survive on the planet. That's the situation we're in. That this isn't just about human thriving, it's about finding ways collectively to survive on a planet that is becoming, as Giles put it earlier, increasingly turbulent in all measurable aspects. This means that we have to find new ways to reach for the best in one another. We have to find new forms of design that better enable us to integrate within natural systems, to understand that we're not separate from the planet, but as some people have said, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the ecology. There's no getting over that. If we keep blowing through ecological boundaries, we are bound to suffer. One of the big challenges in environmental storytelling is that this is always set up, to my mind, as we can find technological solutions that will take us forward, or we can retreat into the caves and shiver in the dark. And those are not our options at all. Every option moving forward will be highly technological, but these technologies can be directed towards all kinds of different purposes. The idea that if we shy away from certain technological options, we are sacrificing something is not true. If we better our lives and better enable human systems to thrive within ecological limits. So we need to find better ways to tell those stories. Every option moving forward is highly technological, but we need to direct those technologies towards the right ends.
Thank you. And let's give our panelists a round of applause. Thank you, Giles, for...